This is The Think Tank, talking about the major economic, political, and social issues of the week. On the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3, KTAR, here's Dr. Mike O'Neill and Mike Russell.
Well, here's Mike O'Neill without Mike Russell. We're flying solo today. Big goings on, however. The drums of war are beating. We have been absolutely outraged in this country by beheadings, ISIS, ISIL, in the Middle East. And it looks like we're headed towards something resembling war. If we're going to go to war, shouldn't we at least consider what we're getting into ourselves here? The president at this point says no boots on the ground. I got to wonder if we're going to send in airplanes and one of them gets shot down and some pilot gets beheaded. I wonder how long that no boots on the ground thing lasts. We have a couple of guests here who can provide real insight into what's going. The first is a guest who is calling in from Tel Aviv. Jude Itunde is a Cameroonian. That's Africa, if you didn't get that, folks. He is a national of Cameroon. He's a professional currently working in Israel. He's worked in France, the USA, is a graduate of Thunderbird, and has worked as well in Rwanda for the last 15, and all of those places for the last 15 years. Hello and welcome.
Thank you.
Second welcome. Guest is Jalene Lissay, has been here before. In fact, the origin of this particular show was I read an absolutely insightful posting that she made. She hardly makes any other kind. And it provoked me to think, and I said, we've got to turn this into a show. About a year ago, she also sent me an article about what was happening in the Middle East, and particularly the number of Muslim fanaticists who were entering the nation of Syria through Turkey. And basically, and she said, this just scares the bejeebus out of me. And frankly, she was about a year ahead of the time, because that's ISIS, that's ISIL, that's what we've seen since. She's an expert on leadership and conflict resolution with over 20 years experience in working in that matter. And again, I was just blown away by her prescience here. So we're going to talk about the Middle East. I want to start out and maybe give the listener just a little bit of background. We hear Shiites and Sunni, and a lot of this is sectarian, which means it's intranescent warfare between those two groups. And I found myself constantly confused by this, who's where. And I even made a little coloring map of who's where. And I think I'm trying to figure out how I can simplify it for radio. And I think if we focus on the big countries, there's an easy way to do it. Forget Sunnis for a minute. That's everything else. The Shiites are predominant in Iran. They're 95% of the country. They are about 60-65% of Iraq and maybe 15% of Syria. And they're almost nowhere else. They're minority in other places. Tell me if I have that wrong. They're in some other Yemen. There's some other places that just might confuse you right now.
Well, you actually, yeah. I mean, in Bahrain, they're actually the majority. Well,
but they're not. I mean, that's not a player. Right. I mean, just to simplify it now, in terms of the major combatants, if you think Shia, think they are overwhelmingly in Iran, the majority in Iraq, and they're more or less a minority in all of the other combatants. So that is going to play out in this. And I want to start with Jude and ask you for a little bit of history. How do we get into this mess?
Well, just with reference to the Sunni-Shia divide, one might add, although they're a minority overall, only 10% of Muslims globally, they are sometimes a majority in critically strategic places. For example, in Saudi Arabia, the region where all the oil is produced from, guess what? It's majority Shiite, for example. So you find a lot
even though it's a minority stuff in the country as a whole.
Exactly. So you have a lot of stuff like that happening in the Middle East, which obviously complicates things politically. With regard to your question, how did we get to this place? Which mess exactly are you talking about?
I think from an entirely domestic standpoint, from the mess that once more we are talking about whether or not it is necessary for the United States to get militarily involved.
I think This moment is fascinating. Being a history buff, I think it's one of those, I think we're at a turning point, because American public opinion is realizing that what exactly this long war means. It's realizing that the fact that it's had to intervene now three times militarily in the Persian Gulf and in Iraq is not by chance. There are long-term historical trends going on here. And this moment in particular, where basically American public opinion and the president is asking himself reluctantly, coming to the conclusion that there needs to be another round of another Iraq war. That's what's basically confronting the United States right now. And not only another round of the Iraq war, but an acknowledgement that this is a new long war that will last several generations. It's already been, one has already come of age since September 11th, and America needs to organize itself to win this fight for the long haul if it wants to wage it. And there's a big question mark over whether there's an appetite and a will in the U.S. to actually wage it.
So I have, you know, so I share Jude's perspective a bit, but when you ask, you know, how did we get here? It was interesting. You know, we haven't always heard a lot before, you know, from the first Bush administration on how we've gotten to where we are now. And I was watching the Meet the Press, I think it was last Sunday, and former Secretary Baker was on, and he actually, it was the first time I've actually heard someone say from that administration, we consciously decided not to go after Saddam because we knew that taking him out would lead to what we're dealing with now.
And no, wait, there's been a fascinating videotape of Dick Cheney saying exactly the same thing.
Oh, really? I've missed that one.
This is under Bush 1 when he was, I believe, defense secretary. And he gives an absolutely compelling case about why it would be absolutely ludicrous to go in and take out Saddam. Specifically, we're talking about we are fighting or proxy war against Iran, and Saddam serves as a bulwark against Iran, who we thought for a while was our most dangerous enemy in the Middle East. And it would be, under those circumstances, absolutely ludicrous. We knock out Saddam, says Dick Cheney, and then what happens? And there is no good outcome from there. And that's not what he said several years later, but when he was defense secretary, that was what he said. We're going to continue this discussion with Jalene Lissay and Jude Ituni in just a moment, and we'll be back on the Think Tank, 92.3 News Talk KTAR.
You're listening to the Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona, News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are in the Think Tank at KTAR with Jude Ituni, who's calling in from Tel Aviv, and in the studio, Jalene Lissay. And Jude, I want to ask you a question that we did a pre-interview, and I thought you had a very interesting set of observations about ISIS, ISIL, which is sort of the latest terrorist organization that we're concerned about. And you made some very, very interesting points about the difference between ISIS or ISIL on the one hand and Al-Qaeda on the other.
Well, there are some, in many ways, there are no basic differences. The ideology and the objectives are the same, but there are some tactical and some operational differences which explains the divergence. ISIL used to be Al-Qaeda in Iraq, run by Abu Musab al-Zarqawi. And he was known within jihadist circles and within Al-Qaeda as someone who was very independent from bin Laden. He set up his own training camps. And someone who was ferociously anti-Shia, which explains the violence he unleashed on Iraqi Shiites once after the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And that spirit still survives to this day within ISIL.
Just so people get the point of this, Saddam Hussein was supported by the Sunnis, who were a minority in Iraq, And yes. But who nevertheless were running the country. So the minority is now out, and Saddam Hussein's exactly. officers, some of them are part of this, right?
Exactly. Now that's the innovation that ISIL brings to the table. They've basically merged Al Qaeda's terrorist expertise and terrorist networks with military officers from former military officers, elite military officers from an elite army, and the merging of the two has resulted in what we see today with ISIL, which isn't just a terrorist network, but actually an army and an administration which has logistical lines, which is capable of holding and managing territory, and which has an economy. Now, albeit one based on organized looting, not just occasional looting, but really systematic looting. People's chevrolets are being taken, and they have to buy them back. There's all sorts of black market activity. Now, it's very rudimentary, and we can discuss whether it's sustainable or not, unless you expand it. But it is an economy. So, in terms of sophistication, ISIL is one step up, which also explains why its leader, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, feels that he is strong enough to demand allegiance from all the world's jihadists now and become the new caliph, the new capore tutti capi of all jihadists.
Well, you know, and Jude, one of the things that you just made a good point on when you talk about Saddam's former, you know, leaders joining now what's ISIL or ISIS, that's been happening all over. That happened in Libya as well. You know, once Gaddafi was gone, what we have never taken into consideration as we've gone into places is what to do with the people that once we overthrow the leader, what happens to all of those that were around them. And Gaddafi had hundreds, if not thousands, of mercenaries, well-trained mercenaries, who then went free, I mean, just went out and are looking for power grabs. And they're the ones who have joined up with the different factions that have gone into Mali and different places, you know, absolutely. Creating a lot of the havoc that we're having. And so that's part of our shortcomings when we approach these countries, is that we're not looking at who all the players are and where they're going to go once we take one leader out.
You know, what this reminds me of is the situation in the disintegration of the Soviet Union. You remember the Soviet Union still existed for a while, but Russia was quasi-independent. Boris Yeltsin had taken over as sort of a West-leaning leader. And significantly, Yeltsin was paying the army. And the moment you start paying the army, you have a claim on their loyalty. And so I think of, this Saddam Hussein's army. It's a, you know, could we have confined them to their barracks and start paying their paychecks? And then you, instead of having what became an incredible, remember the surge and the insurgency against this? This was Sunni. This was former army officers. This were people who had really good jobs in Saddam Hussein's army. And now they find themselves the victim of persecution and they're angry and they got guns.
Exactly. I mean, that's what we're seeing, you know, and they have the skill sets. They have the skill sets to mobilize, just as Jude was talking about. And we do not have a strategy, as far as I can see, to actually deal with what it is that we're going to be focusing now on the ground.
Jude, what do you think we should do at this point?
That's a big question. It gets back to this question, to this broader question of what does America want to do in the world? Because depending on that, the answer is not the same.
I'm not sure America knows what it wants to do. I think we have tolerance for very brief, highly successful, painless wars.
Exactly. And the thing is, you cannot defeat ISIL this way, because it is an actual army that also merged with a terrorist network. You're going to need a mix of what was done in Afghanistan and what was done with the overthrow of Saddam Hussein. And afterwards, you will need staying power, meaning American troops will need not just, and by American troops, I mean ground troops, including ground troops, will be needed not just to defeat ISIL, which will be relatively easy to do with the requisite amount of force, but troops will be needed afterwards to stay there and provide the political and the military backup to whatever local allies America has been able to bring towards it so that they can organize and hold the territory, exactly what happened with the surge. One of the things that Donald Rumsfeld often insists on is that the surge worked not because it was it wasn't the fact of sending additional troops in of itself that changed the situation. It's just that it arrived at a moment where America's will to stay was put in question in Congress, and people were wondering what was the president going to pull the troops out, and he did the opposite and sent troops, and that galvanized those potential allies in waiting for America in that were there, and that allowed Maliki to move and to make the necessary concessions with the Sunnis, and made the surge work. Now, something like this, I think, is possible in Syria, but it will require that staying power and sending that message that these people are going to be confronted for the long term. And I'm just not sure that those requirements are something that American public opinion and its president are ready to stomach right now.
I think you're absolutely right in terms of that. There is no stomach for boots on the ground, as the president has said, no boots on the ground, basically because I think he reads that that is simply not going to fly. I think the other point I'd make about the surge, it worked to the extent that the Sunni forces were convinced that they were not going to be cut out of the Iraqi government. That lasted for a while, and then it wasn't. We are approaching a hard break here. I would like to thank Judae Atunde for joining us. Jaylene will be back with me after our break, and we will discuss where we go from here, domestic implications and the like.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are back in The Think Tank. We would like to thank Judae Atunde, who had joined us from Tel Aviv. Jaylene Lacey is still here. And you had a radically different take. He suggested the only way we're going to do this is with American boots on the ground. My observation, I don't think there's political support for that, but you don't think that's the way to go, even if there was?
No, I don't. And, and we're in a tough situation because when it comes to Iraq, we do carry responsibility. We do carry responsibility for the safety of the Iraqi people because they are in the situation they're in today because we went there.
That Colin Powell doctrine, you broke it, you fix it. You own it?
To a certain extent, there is a piece of that that's going on. Mm-hmm. At the same time, as long as here we are, when you look at the terrorism that's been growing and you look at, Judae laid it out really well in terms of how ISIS has grown to be as strong as they are. But, the way I look at it, and I don't know how many people are familiar with Pokemon. It's a game that my son plays, but you start out very
small.
Anybody
who had a kid of a certain age is, and I'm among them.
Okay, so it starts off with this little tiny thing, right? And as you win or as you continue with the game, it starts to get bigger and bigger, and it grows and evolves until it's a much more fierce fighter. And that's what's happening with terrorism. When we started with bin Laden, he was a very small entity who was able to do some considerable damage, but he was small and he was isolated. And then when we changed the fabric, instead of just going after bin Laden, when we decided to take on Iraq, it changed the whole ballgame. And
we elevated him with our language, among other things. We described this as a war, and
yes.
War is the biggest word we got. And not that what the action wasn't outrageous, and not that it wasn't totally deserving of response, but linguistically, we elevated him to the status of a country.
Absolutely. And we treated it. Yes, it was like nation against nation.
As opposed to saying this is a criminal act and you will be found and there will be finality and you will be punished. But without elevating you to the status, words like war are used towards countries.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so as a result, every faction that we keep coming up against is getting stronger and stronger, is evolving to another level. And we can take out ISIS. And if we do it the way that we're doing it, and if it's us on the ground, my concern is we haven't seen what the next evolution of ISIS is going to be. And there will be another evolution.
The thing that strikes me about this, when they did those public beheadings, first of all, we were outraged, as we should be. It was an outrageous, barbaric act. Think for a second, though. What did they want us to do?
Right.
And we've done exactly what they wanted us to respond big. That was a deliberate provocation so that we elevate their status, I suppose, to that of the premier terrorist organization in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can't, you know, I can't speak for what they were thinking, but absolutely they're trying to get attention.
I'll make an inference based on their act. I don't know what's in their mind, but I know what their action is. I know that, I mean, you behead and you do it on television. You expect any Western power to look at that and to be completely outraged.
Well, and that's the key. It was designed to outrage the West. You know, if you look at Saudi Arabia, in August alone, 22 people were beheaded. And I think 8 of those were under the age of 25 or something. I mean, it was like they're young people who were beheaded. A couple of them were beheaded.
How come I haven't heard of this before?
Well, you have to look for it in our news, but it is in the news. But you do have to look for it. And the fact is, I mean, that goes into the whole piece that I was going to say that was different than Judea is that there needs to be boots on the ground, but they shouldn't be American boots. We need to be engaging. I mean, right now it seems like we're begging, and instead of demanding that Saudi and Qatar, you know, Kuwait, other countries in the Gulf, especially who really have something to fear. They should be the ones on the ground. We've sold them billions of dollars worth of weapons. We just did an $11.9 billion weapons sale to Qatar while they were actually housing Hamas's leaders during, you know, the recent conflict between Israel and Hamas.
Don't we make it easy for them? I mean, if our first reaction is we're going to go in there, we're going to take these guys out, we let everybody else off the hook, don't we?
Absolutely. And not only are we letting people off the hook, but we are, as long as it is the U.S., and non-Muslims attacking Muslims. In the Muslim world, we're not winning the war. We're not even winning the propaganda war. You know, I have, you know, a lot of colleagues in a lot of different Arab countries who will tell me, and they're highly educated, and they're business leaders, and they do very well for themselves, and they're anti-terrorism, but they also don't see the difference between the U.S. and ISIS. They absolutely do not see what we're doing as any different than what they're doing. And as long as that's the case, we're never going to win. And the only way to shift that is that they need to start taking responsibility and control and being the ones with the boots on the ground. And we can be there to support them. It's kind of like what we just did with the Al-Shabaab in Kenya. You know, the AU, the African Union, has troops.
You're going to have to explain that.
Okay, so the Al-Shabaab is a terrorist organization, which is very similar to ISIS.
They were the ones who did that terrorist thing in the mall, right?
Okay. Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. But what's happened is it's been an African response. The African Union has pulled together troops, and they went into Somalia to try and crush the Al-Shabaab. And what we have been doing is supporting their efforts. They are the boots on the ground. They are taking the initiative. And just recently, when the leader of the Al-Shabaab, when they knew where he was going to be, we sent in a drone and we took him out. And we did it very successfully. And we've done a lot to dismantle the Al-Shabaab. Is it destroyed? No. But the AU is in there. They've got their boots on the ground and they're doing everything they can to take the support that we've given them and do what's necessary to shut them down.
You know, interestingly, I think it was an awkward and probably inappropriate phrase, but I think a brilliant strategy. That sounds to me a lot like leading from behind.
I think
I think they could have come up with a more artful way to phrase that,
right.
But I think the thread there is that the moment it becomes an American deal, first of all, everybody sits back on their hands and say, okay, America's, that's their problem.
Right.
Secondly, it's much easier for America to become the enemy because we're the outsiders, as opposed to another Muslim force in the Middle East.
Right.
And it's hard for me not to draw an analogy, frankly, with Vietnam, in that the French are in there, they're colonialist, and they're the enemy, and then the Japanese are in there as an invader. And then all of a sudden, it's the Americans who we say, no, we're Americans. We're not like the French or the Japanese. We're the good guys, but we've come halfway around the world, and it's not our country, and it's very easy for us to become the enemy if we're out front, as opposed to, we may have dropped the ball on that, but it seemed to me, at least in the first phase, that the action taken in Libya had a certain level of success because it was Libyans who were leading the charge initially, who got a little bit of help from us at a critical moment. But it was not an American operation.
No. In fact, the French, I think, even had a stronger role than we did initially in
They're
Libya.
Closer.
Right. Exactly.
I think there might have been Italians in there, too, which is real close.
But that's what needs to happen on this. I mean, unless we see Arab boots on the ground, unless we see the different countries really taking a stand for the region, because it's going to go well beyond Iraq, well beyond Syria, if they don't start taking, you know, control of the situation for themselves with our supporting their efforts, if it's going to be us leading it, we're just going to continue to lose because we haven't won it yet.
How do you make that happen?
That is the question. And that, you know, of course, we could then talk about the oil and those kinds of things. I mean, I still don't understand fully why we support Saudi Arabia the way we do. Nothing that they stand for. I mean, everything that we were against Saddam Hussein is everything that's happening in Saudi today. Women have no rights. Beheadings happen regularly. There is no justice. Slavery is still alive and well in terms of, especially, you know, they call it indentured servitude, but it's really, it's slavery. Horrible, gross acts of injustice all the time. The mechanisms that ISIS is using, all of those are the Saudi justice system. And yet we never hold Saudi accountable. And right now the Saudi king said, we need to jump on this, or you say that Americans need to act, and we're starting to act, but we're not saying, what are you going to do first?
You know, I wonder if it's the trappings in that they are in power, and they do so not from out in a dusty road in the back end of a Toyota. They do that from government buildings and gold-plated everything. And so its visual look is very different.
Absolutely. You know, and then we have that, it's that oil, that's that little oil issue. That keeps coming up.
And our dependency is maybe being reduced, but it's still there. It's probably more there for Europe now than for us, but it's still a factor. And, yeah, that oil spigot goes out. We remember even back, you know, as far as 73, they cut off that spigot, and it was catastrophic. Hard to know. We're going to wrap this up in the next segment. By the way, if you want to catch earlier shows, they are all on my website, which is mikeoneal.org, all but the last several. The last several shows will be on the station's website, ktar.org. You push a button for all stations, and then you can borrow down, and if you can find it, we're in there somewhere. But we will be back with Jalene Lissay and wrap this up in just a moment. KTAR News 92.3.
You're listening to The Think Tank on the Voice of Arizona. News Talk 92.3 KTAR.
We are back in The Think Tank with Jalene Lissay. By the way, I do want to plug how I came in contact with you, Jalene, in the first place. Absolutely fabulous TED Talk. You want to spell your name for folks? They can go Google that. It just caught my attention and well worth listening to.
Sure. It's Jalene, J'Lein, Lissay, Lisse.
And if you don't know what TED Talks are, Google that one. They're some of the most insightful, inspiring, and informative talks, and they're all max out at about 15 minutes, so you don't fall asleep. They not only have substance, but did they train you in how to talk concisely, or they coach that? Or
no, there's no training, but you are told you have this amount of time, and you don't go over, and then you have to show that you can do that, and then it's done.
Because they are consistently concise and pithy, and there's no way. It's sort of like it's your average 45-minute talk with all the fluff taken out. So I have been musing on this a little bit, and I'm hearing the drums of war are beaten, and it's hard for me not to hearken back to times in my life when I've heard this before. And the first time was in Vietnam. The Gulf of Tonkin, for those of you who are under 50, our ships on the high seas were attacked by North Vietnamese planes, and everybody got furious. And Lyndon Johnson got a resolution of Congress to escalate the war. We found out years ago that it looks like the whole thing was faked. And subsequent, and when they found out that the basis might have been suspect, later on, like years later, the various presidents had said, well, we didn't do it on that basis anyway, but that was part of the history. I think of the second or first Gulf War, both of them, really. We had to get ginned up. We got ginned up about the invasion of Kuwait, which was real and outrageous. And the second time, weapons of mass destruction. You know, this is a guy who's going to get atomic bombs and put us under threat. And those turned out not to be the case. But I'm looking at this. I'm looking at the visuals of the beheadings, and I wonder if we're creating this monster, which is absolutely, I mean, it, there's no question. The outrage, the savagery is real. It offends the conscience. But as you pointed out, in that same period, Saudi Arabia, our good friends, beheaded more. I'm just wondering, that it's sort of, the more outraged we get, the more it's time to pause and think, all right, I'll accept that it's outrageous, but what are we getting into? What are our objectives, and how are we going to pull them out? And one of the things we talked about was the fact that we may be more effective if we're not out front on this.
Right. And I just want to also clarify one question, or it's really a question. Are we outraged or are we scared? And I think, and maybe we're both.
I think it's both. Let me qualify that. And certainly in the Middle Eastern case, I think scared is a big part of that. Scared got us to do all kinds of things in the Cold War. I mean, we landed man on the moon partially because we were trying to prove our superiority and we needed to advance science. It also had byproducts in higher education. We funded higher education like never before, and not just science and math. We did foreign languages. We did arts. We did everything. National Defense Education Act, it was called. It was across the board, and it was the most massive funding of higher education probably anywhere, anytime in the world, and it was fundamentally a response to the threat of communism. Now, you have said that you don't think we beat ISIS with guns and bombs. How do we do it? Or do we have to do it?
Well, I think, you know, again, there's a couple of different levels here. I mean, one is there needs to obviously be people, you know, boots on the ground and someone taking, you know, trying to limit the destruction that they're causing. And that's going to take a military response.
Who has the military to do that?
You know, I think that we need to see in the Gulf the same thing that Africa has done. There needs to be some sort of, you know, call it the Gulf Union in terms of forces, just like they have the African Union. But there needs to be some kind of Gulf military troops that are taking the lead, and again, that we're supporting those efforts. And at the same time, one of the things that we're really good at is building economies. And right now, you know, that is the one area that I think. When we look at the recruitment for people who are being recruited by ISIS or different, or Al Qaeda or different factions, it's those who don't feel like they really have a hope or a place for anything else in society, and this is their leg up. If people had other viable opportunities for a leg up, they would take it. I've seen that in our own country. I've seen it in Africa. I've seen it in different places. So one of the things that we are really good at as a country is building businesses, entrepreneurialism, you know, getting business started, starting, you know, the creativity that it takes to build that sector. And that is a sector that's not happening. There is a desire for it. But when you have 70% of the population in the entire Middle East under the age of 30, most under the age of 25, and even beyond that, you know, a huge number under the age of 18, there needs to be a focus, not just on education, but employment. And if we can get in there and make sure that that part is being taken care of, and that's something that we're very good at, and we have the companies to help us out with that, that will make a huge difference, even more so than the guns and the bombs, because we can stop ISIS now, but there's going to be another version of it later on, unless we can stop the recruitment capabilities that they have, and that's going to be through an economic solution.
There seems to be no shortage of money to fund this if they had the will in the Middle East, right?
Right.
I mean, I listen to that and say, this doesn't have to be our money. It could be our support. Though I also think trying to do this in the context of an immediate war zone is pretty tough.
No.
I mean, you don't start a viable economic business while people are still shooting.
No. Not in Iraq, not in Yemen, not in Syria. I mean, nothing that's really at the verge of being a fail. I mean, I think Iraq, I don't know if we're calling it a failed state yet. I don't know that we want to call it a failed state, because then we would have a little more responsibility there. But Syria is definitely a failed state, and so is, you know, and so is Yemen.
By the way, I want to ask you about one thing. I think one of the biggest failures was when we put in Maliki, or we allowed Maliki to take over, and he was supposed to set up a broad and inclusive government. He did just the opposite. He said, I'm the Shiite. We've been on the outs. We basically are going to stick it to every Sunni in Iraq. Now, with some pressure from us, they got rid of Maliki. They put in somebody else. Do you think, and I didn't even know the name of the guy who followed him, Is he more credible? Is he actually reaching out? Because it seems to me, short of that, they have no credibility. Then they are not a government of a country. They are a faction of Shiites. And frankly, what feeds ISIS is disaffected Sunnis.
Right. Well, and that is where we are in a, you know, rock and a hard place in Iraq, because we are now responsible for Iraqis' futures, like it or not. And so we did have responsibility there. And I don't know enough about this new person to know what he's going to do or not do. But that is where, you know, one thing that we said from the very beginning and one thing that President Bush said is that Iraq was not going to be another state of the United States. But in some ways, we may not have, it's not that they're going to be another state of the U.S., but we have responsibility there. And whoever is their leadership, we can't just walk away from that if they are not leading.
The sad thing about this is it's very clear. This goes beyond Barack Obama's presidency, doesn't
it? Absolutely.
This is not over. You know, somebody else is president, maybe several people by the time this one is over. Well, you're the expert here. You got about a minute. What one takeaway would you want the audience to most have about what we ought to do?
I think we have to really start to educate ourselves in this country about what's happening over in the Middle East. And I think that we cannot allow ourselves to be hijacked by fear, but we have to actually go back to our great capacity for reasoning and critical analysis. And we need to really, really seek to understand what the different dynamics are before we make decisions on what to do. Because just being reactive is only going to continue to escalate the issue.
Hard to see that coming about in the midst of all this shooting and all this outrage. I mean, the imagery, the reason we're moving back in, I think, is the beheadings, because that's what has outraged people. And at that, I think, is what has made it tolerable to do anything, because this country clearly had war fatigue, has war fatigue. But, you know, you look at those visuals without even actually having seen them, you got an idea of what's there. And it's pretty hard. We're not ready to sustain this. Is what I think. I think we're in a lot of fatigue over this, and figure that what we wanted was out. What Barack Obama wanted was out. Well, I don't know that we solved anything. Hopefully, we have inspired or at least educated a little bit. Jalene Lissay, thank you very much once again. And also to Jude Ituni, who called in earlier from Tel Aviv. We'll be back next week with political analysis on the Think Tank.